With me this week is Craig Urush, author of the Essay on Commerce for the Founders of the Constitution series. Urush is a professor of history at UCLA and a specialist in political ideas of colonial and revolutionary America. Welcome, Craig.
Thank you.
At the start of your essay, you write that even though the United States is a preeminent example of a nation dedicated to free enterprise and commercial activity, the relationship between Republican government and commerce was one of the central problems that confronted the founders in the late 18th century. I found that sentence intriguing. Could you explain it a bit?
The basic idea there is that the ancient idea of Republican government, the one that they had imbibed in their reading, tended to be anti-commercial. That is, Republican government was conceived in the ancient world and then as it was revived in the early modern period as a government where citizens devoted all of their attention to the public good and the private sphere was considered to be less legitimate or less important. And there was considered to be a serious tension between one's duties to the republic as a citizen and one's private activity. So money making and commerce and luxury were seen as taking you away from your duties to the common good. So the founders had to construct a Republican government in an age which did take commerce seriously and in which there were newer ideas that were defending commerce. So they're trying to bring these strands together in the late 18th century as they create Republican governments.
Okay, good. I want to come back to that political philosophy, but let's provide some historical perspective on why commerce was such an issue. The American colonies, as you also write in your essay, were really originated as commercial enterprises, something that may surprise some of our listeners who tend to see the colonies as perhaps political or religious havens. Could you explain that a bit?
Well, right. I mean, both those things are true. I think we sometimes tend to focus maybe excessively on questions of religion, and we focus a lot on New England. But if you look more broadly at all the colonies, and indeed, in fact, if you include the West Indies, which were also British colonies founded at the same time in the 17th century, certainly commerce and the desire for profit and for material improvement were really central impulses in the colonizing enterprise and really did, I think, shape the character of these nascent colonial societies. So there was a real concern to be involved in production and trade and to, in a sense, make money.
Now, it seems to me this occurred on two levels. First of all, you had colonies, at least in the early years, that were actually corporate colonies. But then you also had the other level of individuals that were seeking to make a better life for themselves.
Right, exactly. And you had also companies, as you say, that were forms of joint stock companies as well, right? In fact, the early Virginia Company was founded essentially as a private corporation, in a sense, to make money off colonization. So there were a variety of different things. And then the impulse, as you say, for the individuals to go often was for betterment, for material improvement, for the desire for a better life, in addition to questions of freedom of religion and escaping persecution. So both those impulses were there, I think, right at the start.
Okay. So although the corporate colonies didn't work out very well, the individual initiative certainly became increasingly important.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Now, we still have to emphasize here that the colonies were dominantly agricultural. So how, in fact, did they become commercial at the same time?
Well, I think what's interesting about that actually is in the 17th century and increasingly in the 18th century, agriculture was a form of commerce. If you think about the middle colonies, for example, in the 18th century, think about Philadelphia as a real entrepot in the Atlantic, a commercial center. Part of that was actually selling on the products of this burgeoning colonial agriculture. So the merchants in the cities and the Atlantic trade were actually, I would argue, connected to commercial agriculture and agriculture that was being produced. In other words, colonists were producing for more than just use. They were producing for profit and producing for exchange. And so I would argue that those two are tied. Tobacco and the lucrative tobacco crops in the 18th century, sugar in the Caribbean as well. So I would argue that agriculture was, in fact, a part of this increasingly commercial colonial world.
Well, let me just take that a step further. It may be difficult to quantify, but just how extensive was commerce, let's say, by the end of the colonial period? Was it just a matter of a few people being involved in commerce, or was it pervasive?
My argument would be, and there's some debate in the historical literature, my argument would be that it was fairly pervasive, and was fairly pervasive, you know, even in New England. If you think about Boston, shipbuilding, fishing, the timber trade, the huge kind of trade across the Atlantic, which was increasingly important in the mid-18th century and up to the Revolution, where the colonists would be selling raw materials to some extent to England and Britain, and then buying back finished goods, consumer goods, increasingly luxury goods. So I would argue that these were commercial places, and that was a central aspect of their life.
Okay, let's switch to the world of ideas here from the real world. And the authors of the U.S. Constitution, although they lived in a world of commerce, were also the product of their times in terms of the world of ideas in which they lived. And a lot of these ideas, as you develop in your essay, relate to the whole idea of commerce or property. So let me just mention a few and you can explain them. How about English common law and property rights?
Very important influence. You know, as many of us know, the founders were lawyers, at least a lot of them were lawyers. The English common law had, for many centuries before the founding, stressed property as an absolutely central legal and political value, political institution, and gave protection to private property, I think in a way that was actually unique within the European context at the time. So there was an emphasis on property. And writers in the common law tradition not only associated property with liberty, that is, if you own property, you were free from the arbitrary authority of the king, but they also associated property and an English system of laws with commercial prosperity, which they contrasted with what they saw as the poverty of, say, a French regime, what they would have seen as an absolutist regime. So there was always was an idea of property, I think, and property and commerce in the English common law, at least the sanctity of property, private property.
And of course, that's central to commerce. But John Locke develops this, I think, probably more than anyone else. Tell us a little bit more about Locke's ideas.
Locke really, I think, innovates with the idea of property. He argues that property is a natural right, and he argues that you can, that is, individuals can create property by their own labor, and that this is actually a way to justify the ownership of property. You're not granted property, but you can create your own property by your own effort, by your own labor. Really powerful formulation of this he makes in the Second Treatise of Government, which was widely read in the American colonies. And in fact, you can find this argument being used by many colonists in the 18th century, where they say, well, we labored on the land, therefore we should own it. We can fence it in. We can own it absolutely as a private property right. Locke also does something interesting where he starts to argue, and here he's sharing this idea with a lot of other thinkers, that if you have private property, you have greater wealth for everybody. So you can see a sort of a utilitarian argument developing, right, where private property is related to social betterment, to the greater good.
Okay, so just to take that point up just a step further, by Locke saying that there's a natural right to property, he's not saying that there's a role of government in guaranteeing property, but rather that individuals have the right to earn property.
Right, they earn property. And what's interesting about Locke's theory is you already own property in what he called a state of nature, that is, in a pre-governmental state, and then you take your property into civil society or political society, and in fact, you form that political society to protect property, I mean, among other things. So that actually, I would argue, makes the property right stronger, because one of the conditions of entering into civil society is property rights, and therefore, Locke argued, if the government violates your property rights, as he thought the English kings were doing in the late 17th century, there were grounds actually for resistance.
Okay, and in a reference that clearly made all the capitalists in the room stand up and applaud, Locke really defended commercial societies based on private property by arguing that they were productive of greater wealth for all of those in society.
Right, exactly. It's what we would now call a utilitarian argument for property, and that's very central, I think, to his thinking about property and more broadly about commerce.
Now, Locke wasn't alone. As you indicate, there's Montesquieu, who really equated commerce with eliminating destructive prejudices by fostering peaceful trade. You want to develop that?
Yeah, this is a very interesting development in, you know, European intellectual life in the 17th century and increasingly in the 18th century. We talked a bit briefly at the start of the interview, there was a lot of skepticism about commerce in classical thought. Well, the early modern period starts developing arguments, and Montesquieu central to this, that commerce is actually productive of a better society. It creates peaceful societies. It creates societies that are not racked by war and conflict. It creates actually more egalitarian societies because all of the wealth is not being dominated by the court, right, by the kings and the courtiers, but ordinary people can produce wealth. And then further, if people produce wealth and trade with other people, it fosters peaceful relations among nations, among the peoples of the world. So you get a kind of a nascent laissez-faire argument in Montesquieu in the early 18th century, which of course is then taken up by Adam Smith and then the Scottish writers in the 18th century, who really see a compatibility between self-interest and the greater good and see a lot of benefits from commercial commercial activity and see their age as a commercial age, which is a real improvement over previous ages. It's more peaceful, more productive, more civil, and really make a, I would argue, a staunch defense of commercial societies.
Okay. In the opposing corner, one might say, however, right, we do have some naysayers, those who call into question this whole idea of self-interest for being for the common good. Tell us a little bit about them.
We talked briefly about this idea of classical republicanism, and there really is a strong strand in a lot of ancient writers, as I mentioned at the start of the interview, that commerce and a concern with the private takes you away from what you should be doing, that is, as a citizen, which is devoting all of your time to the public good. So commerce was always viewed with some suspicion. There was always a concern that commerce led to luxury, and if people get too luxurious, they become corrupt again, and then they're likely to lose the republican government that they've created. So the ancient world really had a cyclical theory where it was actually commerce, or at least the growth of wealth and luxury, that then led to a decline of republican government, because again, people would turn away from their duties as citizens. Christian thought as well has a strong strand, as I argue in the essay, of a real skepticism about commerce, right? I mean, in other words, too concerned with this world, with things that are material, not enough with the other world, with our religious duties. And those two strands of thought are still very, very important in the 18th century. They don't go away. And they are also influential on the American founders when they think about this issue.
Okay. Well, we don't have time to develop this in very much depth, but we faced a number of problems in the 1780s. You had the loss of British markets. You had inability to tax with the new national government. You had extreme debts, huge debts, really. No national control over interstate commerce or even foreign trade. How was all this dealt with when the founders actually went to Philadelphia and put together the Constitution?
Right. Well, the Constitution, really one of the genesis of the Constitution, and Madison, you know, is the prime mover here, but Hamilton as well, is essentially to create, as I argue in the essay, a large commercial republic. They saw the 1780s and the years, particularly after 1783, after the War of Independence was over, they saw them as years that were productive of conflict, that the state governments could not agree, the state governments could not pay their debts, they were issuing paper money, property rights of people who were creditors were being attacked. They saw the central government under the Articles of Confederation as too weak, as unable to raise the taxes necessary. So they argue and construct in the Constitution, at least the legal form for a national government, which would really create a large commercial area, sort of a large free trading area within the United States, with a common currency, with property rights protected from state legislatures, with the power to regulate commerce if necessary, to set a common tariff. So there's really, I would argue, in part, one of the things behind the Constitution is the idea of a large-scale commercial republic. And you can see this in the Federalist Papers very clearly. Hamilton and Madison in particular argue for this.
As long as you've brought up Madison and Hamilton, writing through the Constitution and providing for all that you just mentioned doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be implemented. And you had these two figures who both supported the Constitution having a falling out during the Washington administration. Very briefly, what happened there?
Well, that's a very complicated story. Politically, in one sense, Madison starts to have misgivings to some extent about maybe some of the powers that this central government has. And then there's also questions about the propriety of commercial activity. Jefferson actually becomes maybe as important as Madison does, where he really starts arguing against Hamilton's vision. What Hamilton comes in the 1790s with this idea of state-directed or federal government-directed commerce, where the federal government's going to incur a debt, it's going to fund infrastructure and improvements, it's going to create manufacturing that it would support and subsidize with tariffs. So I think Madison and Jefferson react against this very powerful Hamiltonian vision in a variety of different ways. And I think there's a lot of more practical issues that are at the heart of the dispute, but I think they really react against this Hamiltonian vision of a very powerful federal government, in a sense, supporting commerce, fostering commerce directly.
Okay. Well, if we had the time, I think we could continue this debate right down to the present, but we're out of time for today, and I just want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Our guest this week has been Craig Urush, professor of history at UCLA and the author of an essay on commerce for the Founders and the Constitution series. This is Talking History.